Let me introduce our panelists. We welcome State Representative Dave Brownsberger, who introduced House 1794 and is in the process of negotiating on it, as I understand. We have Representative Brownsberger was a graduate of Harvard College and Harvard Law School and served as Assistant Attorney General. So he's been long in service of the public. We have here to moderate Honorable Gordon Dorfer, who has been both in private practice as a civil litigator and has been at three of the state's different levels of courts, from the Municipal Court of Boston to the Superior Court, Trial Court, to the Appeals Court. And he is now acting as a neutral in mediation with Chance. Also here is Assistant Professor Matt Marks, who will be giving a review of his doctoral dissertation at Harvard Business School on the effects of non-competes on engineers, particularly in the IEEE, the Institute for Electronic and Electrical Engineers. And then we will have Russell Beck, a partner at Foley Lardner, who is a civil litigator and employment lawyer, who has been involved in drafting H. 1799 with Representative Lori Ehrlich, and has also been participating in revising that statute with Representative Brownsberger. Then we have also here Michael Rosen, from a partner at civil litigator at Foley Hoag, who has a blog on non-compete agreements. He's going to be taking the position of the status quo, even though that might not necessarily be his particular position. I'm Steve Chow. I'm a partner at Burns & Levinson. My particular interest in this is that I've been pushing a Uniform Trade Secret Act for the past 15 years that 45 other states in the District of Columbia enacted, but we still haven't gotten around to doing it. I believe it actually has some benefit, and whether or not something is actually done on non-compete agreements or not, it should be helpful to both employers and employees. So also here today is Scott Persner, who's a columnist at the Globe on Innovation Economy, who's written several times in the past month on this particular subject. I also see Bijan Savet, who's a venture capitalist from Spark Capital, who actually was initiated much of the talk recently on getting going the California route of getting rid of employee non-competes. So with that, I'd like to let Matt start with some introduction on what he's determined empirically on effects of employee non-compete agreements.
Well, thank you, Steve. Before I get into the data, I just wanted to say a word about how I came to study this topic. So I'm a little old for an assistant professor, and that's because before going back to grad school, I spent about 10 years in startup companies both here in Boston and out in Silicon Valley. And so I've had the experience with non-competes, first as an engineer signing them when I joined the company, then later as a manager and an executive hiring people into the company and asking them to sign non-competes. So I come at this with kind of both perspectives. And what I'll try and share with you today is both the results, as Steve mentioned, from a survey we did with the IEEE last year, just some basic data about how non-competes are used. And then what I'll move into are more broader implications from my own dissertation, as well as other researchers in the field, to talk about some of the things we've found in terms of how non-competes affect individuals, mostly in the technology sector. So last summer, in conjunction with the IEEE Engineering Society, we ran a survey of non-compete use. We picked at random 5,000 members of the IEEE throughout the U.S., heard back from just over 1,000 of them from a variety of industries, as you can see here, everything from IT to aerospace to computer hardware and so on. And we asked them several questions about whether they'd signed a non-compete, if so, when, how long, and so on. It would take a long time to go through the whole survey, but I'll just hit a couple of highlights that I think would be of interest. The first is, how long are these contracts? We find that in most cases, they're a year or shorter. But a fifth of the non-competes that people signed were more than a year, up to 2 years. And what really surprised me is that nearly 15% of non-competes are longer than 2 years, and some even longer than 5 years. Second, we asked them, well, when were you asked to sign this non-compete? What I found is that in barely 30% of the time did someone know about the non-compete when they accepted the offer. And thus, more than two-thirds of the time, they had already turned down their other offers, committed to join this company when they were presented with this agreement. And a quarter of the time, which also happened to me twice in my career, it was on the first day. As one person I interviewed said, I never received any information ahead of time before showing up my first day. And then it was health insurance, 401k, and the non-compete. It was either sign it and work here, or don't sign it and don't work here. And so from this and some other things I'll show you, it's really questionable as to how much agency or freedom people have not to sign these contracts. And this was, by the way, particularly true for younger workers who were even less likely to hear about the non-compete when they got their offer, even more likely to have it show up on their desk the first day they started work. Now, this will be of particular interest to this crowd, but barely 1 in 10 people in the survey even spoke to a lawyer about their non-compete. About half of them didn't feel it was necessary, but as many or more wanted to talk to a lawyer, but either the company said it was non-negotiable, don't bother, or they felt under time pressure to sign, especially when it was presented to them on their first day of work. And for younger workers, that rate was less than half, so barely 6% of younger workers checked with a lawyer. And so if you take these together, it might not surprise you that if you graph this out by how young and experienced someone is, we see that younger workers are much more likely to comply with non-competes when they're asked. So this graph, the Q1, Q2, those are quartiles of age and experience. So Q1 is the youngest, least experienced workers. Q4, the oldest, most experienced. And you can see that those below the median, Q1 and Q2, signed the non-compete when asked 95% of the time. Older workers, not so often. And when I first saw this, I chalked it up to naivety and experience. But going back to those previous slides, the younger workers are receiving the non-compete more often on their first day. So it could be that employers are taking advantage of the situation. I mean, no one's admitted to that, but the data suggests there may be something like that going on. So let me switch gears now and talk about more of the implications of non-competes. And to preface this, I should note that in the discussion of non-competes, there's often a lot of focus on Silicon Valley versus Route 128. And that's useful because those are very vivid examples, they're well known, and the history of non-competes goes back literally a couple hundreds of years. But when comparing California with Massachusetts, there could be a lot of alternative explanations for example, why we see more entrepreneurial activity out west. It could be the culture, it could be the weather, it could be greater concentration of venture capital, it could be that they have Berkeley and Stanford. It could be a lot of different things. And so we need, as a research community, we need to be very careful about jumping to conclusions based on comparing different states just wholesale. What we'd really like to do, if we could, is run a lab experiment, right? We'd like to take some state and flip the way it handles non-competes and then do a before and after test. And we were very fortunate, my co-authors and I, to stumble across a state that actually did this. And so, as unlikely as it might seem, we're actually going to go to Michigan, which does not seem like the kind of place that we'd go to study non-competes. We're going to go there because Michigan did exactly this. So what happened is in 1905, back when the auto industry was just getting going, when GM gave birth to Chrysler and so on, the legislature passed Public Act 329, and the text of which is up here, and which looks a lot like California's long-standing ban on non-compete agreements. And this was the law of the land for 80 years until 1985, when the Michigan legislature passed something called the Michigan Antitrust Reform Act. Now, you might say antitrust has nothing to do with non-competes, and you're right. What it did is it strengthened and centralized antitrust law in Michigan, and did that by repealing a number of laws, including Public Act 329, that had some pieces of antitrust law scattered in amongst them. And if you look at the legislative discussion, there are dozens of pages, although there's page after page of antitrust discussion, there's nothing about non-competes, not a word. And this seemed puzzling, and so we got in touch with some labor lawyers who were active at the time in the mid-80s, and they helped us to clarify the situation. They said, there wasn't an effort to repeal non-competes. We backed our way into it. We were not even thinking about non-compete language. Said another one, I'm unaware of anyone that lobbied for the change. Now, this is the sort of thing that enables us to come as close as we can to doing that lab experiment. As researchers, we call it a natural experiment. And so what we're going to do is we're going to build what we call a differences and differences study. We're going to see what was happening in Michigan and treat that as our experimental group. And we're going to take other states that did not enforce non-competes, there are about 10 of them, and use them as a control group. And then we're going to see, you know, how often people, for example, change jobs in Michigan before the change and after. But not just that, we're going to compare that with these control states. Because, you know, maybe people were changing jobs more often in Michigan anyway. You have to really compare versus the control group, just like you would in a clinical trial of a new drug. And so this is what we're able to do here. So let me take you through what we found so far, and I'll also try to corroborate that with what other researchers have found in doing more of the traditional, you know, compare this state versus that state type of studies. How am I doing on time today?
Yep, 5 minutes.
Great. Okay. So the first result, and this was just published last month in the journal called Management Science, is that following the policy reversal in Michigan, which instituted non-competes, knowledge workers in Michigan, by which I mean people who had applied for and been granted patents, so not just electrical engineers, but actually a wide variety of people in all sorts of industries, changed jobs 8.1% less than they had before. Now, you might say, well, in 1985, there could be a lot going on in the auto industry, and there was. And so we control for the changes in the auto industry, where there was actually more people changing jobs. But overall, there was a drop in the job mobility in Michigan. Moreover, this effect was more than double for what we call technical specialists. So not the Java programmer who can go work at hundreds or thousands of different tech companies, but the nanotech researcher who has a very narrow, deep knowledge and can't as easily find work elsewhere. They had 16% less mobility. And this is consistent with a study published 2 years ago by some economists at the Federal Reserve in the Review of Economics and Statistics, who compared California versus other states and found more mobility in the California computer industry. A couple other things from my dissertation. What I'm going to call career detours. And this was based on the fact that non-competes, unlike other types of intellectual property, so they don't just protect the training and skills that a company gives you while you're at the company, but also prior expertise, even expertise gained during education. Said one woman I interviewed, she said, look, I've been in this industry for 20 years. I had a PhD, so gestures like this. I walked in the door with all this experience, and while I was there, they added maybe 2% to that, and then she was barred from working in that industry for 2 years after she left. And this we saw also in Michigan, that after the policy reversal, people were 4.3% more likely, when they changed jobs, also to change technical fields and go off and do something else, presumably in order to avoid the non-compete. This is also consistent with other studies, including an interview study I did picked at random from over 500 inventors in the speech recognition industry, flew around the country and interviewed them. And what I found is, for those who signed a non-compete and then left their job, a quarter of them also left the industry because of the non-compete. They described the reasons, how they wondered what would they do for 2 years while they were out of the industry. Many of them never came back. And they also ended up taking jobs that were lower pay because they couldn't make use of those skills. And this is consistent with a paper by Mark Garmes out at UCLA, who finds that that executives, he's looking at executives, not engineers, are actually paid less in states that enforce non-competes. Now, a lot of us care about entrepreneurial activity, and there's been a lot of work in this area. In Michigan, we found that people, after non-competes were imposed, were less likely to join a small company. This surprised me at first, because I thought that someone, if they'd been subject to a non-compete, might want to try to avoid that again and go to a small company that might not have them or where they'd be able to negotiate. But actually, people were nervous about that. One person said, I didn't feel I could burden a small company with the risk of being sued. So he went and joined a 30,000-person software company in the Pacific Northwest. Also, people noticed that it was easier for large companies to provide kind of a holding tank, to give them something to do for a year that would not infringe on their non-compete, so that they could snap back on day 366 and work in their regular area. Harder for a small company to do that. And this is consistent with a study that's been out for several years by Toby Stewart and Olav Sorensen of Harvard and Yale, in which they found that in the biotech industry, if you looked at what happened just after an IPO or an acquisition, there were more new biotech firms founded in states that don't enforce non-competes. And Olaf also has a follow-on paper where he finds that VC funding is more effective at producing jobs and startups in states that don't enforce non-competes. That's under development. Now, I'm just going to preview one thing that we're working on now, and that is looking to see if there's evidence of a brain drain. So we know from the prior research, from the article we've published, that there's less job mobility within states that enforce non-competes. What we're seeing now is that appears to be compensated for by people, by job mobility out of the state, and in particular, two states that don't enforce non-competes. And we see that both in the, you know, comparing this state versus that one, and also comparing before and after with Michigan. But what's more disturbing from a policy perspective is that this doesn't apply across the board, but in fact, it is the people who are more, the technical folks who are more productive and also more connected, who seem to be the ones to figure out that there are jobs in other states that they can get around the non-compete by leaving, while the less, the lower value, if you will, workers are retained by non-competes. So now, just to wrap up, I think I have maybe 1 minute left. Okay. So to summarize, what we've found, or what we've seen so far, is that non-competes keep workers in their jobs. That's what non-competes are supposed to do. When they leave their jobs, however, they lead to career detours, where they leave their industry, sometimes permanently, and discouraged from founding or joining startups, making it harder to start a company and to grow the company. And non-competes may also drive out high-value workers from the state. Again, we're just working on that now. They disproportionately target young and specialized employees. They're usually presented well after the offer is accepted, and people rarely get legal advice. And just to wrap up, people often ask me, well, how many court cases are there? You know, how often do these go to court? And it turns out that may not be the right metric, because in interviewing people, what I've found is that few of these ever go to, people don't stay in their jobs or leave their industry or avoid a small company because they were hit with a lawsuit or a cease and desist letter. It's because they assumed that the non-compete they signed would be honored. They made a worst case assumption and they said, I signed this, I don't have $50,000 to take it to court, I'm just going to act as if it's enforced. And so there's really a chilling effect, apart from any actual legal activity, that is driving much of what is happening. So if you want to learn more, you can go to my website. I just got permission from the publisher to post a version of that paper this morning if you want to download it and look at it. And I'd love to take any questions at another time.
Thank you, Matt. The format we're going to follow today is that we'll have roughly 15 minutes for panelists, and at the end of the session, we will engage in a panel discussion as well as entertain questions. So with that, I'd like to present Representative Brownsberger on his views.
Thank you very much. Excellent. I don't have slides. Thank you very much for doing this forum, and thank you all for coming out for this. We're working on a bill to address the practice of non-compete agreements. I think the presentation that you just saw illustrates a lot of the motives for our legislation, and I'm glad you're all here because I hope that you'll take the opportunity to give us feedback on this legislation as the opportunity, as you get into the thinking about it. It's right out there on my website, willbrownsberger.com, and it's easy to comment there, and I really welcome that comment. And Russell's got a website, and he can take comments. And so we need input from the professional community. What I'd like to do is talk a little bit about how we came to this legislation, a little bit of the story of the legislation, because I think it's useful to see how different perspectives have influenced the development of the legislation over the past year or two. It started for me with Caroline Wong. Caroline, if you just say hello, raise your hand a little bit. Caroline is a resident of the 24th Middlesex District, so I have the privilege of representing her. And she came to me with this issue. She's an example of a specialized professional in the speech recognition software field whose career took a substantial detour as a result of one of these non-compete agreements. And so she had that story to tell, which resonated for me. And we worked together over the past year or two. I think it was quite a while. Caroline invested in developing an understanding of where the law was in Massachusetts and in other states, and then identifying some people to work with to change that law. One of the people that she brought me to is
Rob Mantell.
I've suddenly blanked on Rob's name, who I've spent so much time with over the past few weeks. Thank you, Caroline. Rob Mantell, the head of the Massachusetts Lawyers Association, Employment Lawyers Association, and his vice chair, Bill Gordon, have given me a lot of valuable input and drafted the first bill that I filed, and then have continue to help me and the group that's formed to put together a good piece of legislation. So I come into it with the perspective of employees who are affected by it. And when I wasn't quite sure, how this whole thing worked, I was coming in cold to the issue. But when I started to get some visibility on the issue, I started to hear from people all over the state who had these bad experiences as a result of non-compete. And I felt very good about being the sponsor of this legislation. And I began to hear from Bijan Sabat, whose leadership on this has also been very important, the venture capital perspective. So I felt like I had, a beautiful issue, right? It's a civil rights issue. Employees are being enslaved by these agreements. And not only are employees being enslaved, but if I stop enslaving them, I'm doing the right thing by the economy of the state. And so it was a beautiful issue. And I still feel basically that there are elements of that perspective. But then I started to hear a little bit, rumblings around the building. One of my colleagues going, what the hell is this you're doing, Brownsburg? Tell us what's going on here. Because they began, other reps, started to hear from members of the business community who had a very different reaction to what we were doing. And Steve DiNatale is a rep from Fitchburg, who's good friends with a guy named Phil Pugin, who's the head of the Small Business Association in England. And he was conveying some of their concerns. And so Carolyn and I and Steve DiNatale went out and sat down with a group from the Small Business Association of New England, including some folks in this room. And they gave us a very different perspective. And in that room, some of these guys, their voices quavered with emotion, talked about, what it would do to their businesses, how hard they worked to build what they had, which was, a business with maybe it's 50, maybe it's 10, maybe it's 200 employees, a relatively small business built around one or two key ideas. These are not venture capitalists who can, spread their risk across dozens and dozens of ideas, nor are these large companies that, again, spread their risk across a large number of ideas, but these are companies that are dependent on something that they've, an idea that they've taken and they've built and they've made something real out of. And so for them, it's not about enslaving employees, it's about bringing somebody into the tent, making them part of the family, and expecting some loyalty in return. And that makes a lot of sense. And so as strongly as I felt about the other way of looking at this situation, I was unable to dismiss that perspective. That's a very serious and real perspective. So I'm always an advocate of simplicity, and when I first encountered Lori Ehrlich's bill that Russ had drafted, I kind of bounced off of it because it was relatively complicated, and thinking, okay, well, this is a full employment act for employment lawyers, and so I wasn't attracted to it initially, but as I continued to struggle with the issue and to realize that there really were two sides to the equation, I developed the perspective that we actually had to have something as complicated as what Russ had developed with Representative Ehrlich. And let me say, by the way, that Representative Ehrlich is sort of now my partner in trying to address something in this field, and she's unfortunately unable to be here tonight because she's now at the National Conference of State Legislators in Philadelphia. She otherwise would have liked to be here. But I think what the perspective that I have now is that there certainly are abuses of these agreements. There are certainly cases where there's bad overreaching by employers, and the vast majority of those cases, as I think you said and your evidence showed, don't end up in court. The employees are fairly junior; they're stuck with these agreements, and their careers are derailed, and perhaps in many instances unnecessarily. I mean, not to defend a legitimate business interest. It's a legitimate business interest that would justify that level of damage to junior people's careers. So the challenge is to write a bill that will substantially change the practice in the field. And I think that's what we've been trying to do, and I hope, I don't know whether we're to the right place yet, but I do believe that we do not have to abolish non-compete agreements in order to we can make a big change in the practice in the industry, and that will be good for innovation in Massachusetts. But at the same time, I think we can respect the legitimate interests of businesses that depend on a degree of loyalty to develop and innovate within their own smaller sandboxes. So that's the perspective that we think about what we're doing. So I'm going to let Russ delve into the bill in a little more specificity. But I think really as you listen to Russ, and I encourage you to do that, think about, to the extent to which, by the way, and I want to emphasize that the bill that we have now, again, reflects a lot of the work of Rob Mantell, as well as the drafting itself by Russ Beck. And so it's a bill that has, I think, includes very strong protections for employees that addresses the issue of, the procedural violations, dumping an agreement on somebody, the day after the day they arrive at work or after that. It addresses the length of agreements. I think it will give employers strong incentives to A, have much shorter agreements, B, have agreements that are much more limited in geographic and substantive scope to protect exactly what they need protecting. So I think it's a good bill. I hope that, there's that saying, political saying, there's nothing in the middle of the road but yellow lines and dead armadillos. I think though that this bill is something that's in the middle that reflects a balance of concerns that actually has a chance of doing the right thing. There is a lot of interest, I will say, in the building. It comes from the work of Scott Kirshner, the work of the Boston Globe editorial board, the work of Vijayan Savin, others who have, Wade Rausch, I guess, in Exconomy. There's a number of folks that are writing about these issues because it's a real issue. It's an issue that has legs that a lot of people are concerned about, and it resonates for a lot of legislators, and so I'm hopeful that we'll be able to get something done. And I thank you for your time and attention today.
Okay, so with that, let me give you the 2-minute summary or less on what the current law is, and we can rest that for Michael, but the statement of the law right now is non-competes, and we're only talking, remember, about employee non-competes. So those are agreements that relate to, that govern the conduct of an employee post-employment. They are enforceable in Massachusetts as long as they are reasonable in time, place, scope of conduct restricted, and they serve a legitimate business interest, but no greater than necessary to serve those interests, and are consonant with public policy. That's what the law is. There are lots of cases discussing what all that means, but right now the law is very unclear. And there is, there are certainly cases that are clear that the agreement can be enforced. There are cases on the other end of the continuum where they cannot be enforced, and then there is an enormous gray area in between, and that's what creates a lot of the problems with non-compete. not all the problems, but a lot of the problems with non-competes. And it was coming from that perspective that Representative Ehrlich and Representative Brownsberger kind of took an approach about how do we find a way to clarify the law, to codify what's there, but with clarification, and to give more predictability to people who are going to either be trying to enforce them or trying to defend against them. And with that was an effort to try to create protections, recognizing employers do have legitimate business interests in trade secrets and confidential information and in their goodwill, not the employee's goodwill, but their goodwill. And on the other hand, that employees have an interest in mobility and moving on to other positions, to advancement, and the rest. And the bill was an attempt to balance those. So what's new in the bill? Non-competes, the case law is a little unclear whether currently non-competes have to be in writing. The bill makes this clear. They must be in writing. They must be signed by the employee and the employer. There's a question in the law about the employee who comes to the employer after, or has a non-compete imposed upon the employee after the employee has been working. We saw some of that reference in Dr. Marks's materials. And the law right now says that that is permissible as long as the employee receives some sort of consideration. What is sufficient consideration? The law's a little murky, but at the appellate level, it seems to be fairly clear that continued employment, that is, if I present you with a non-compete agreement while you're working for me, you don't already have one, but you're working for me, I can just let you continue to work for me, and that's sufficient consideration. The current bill says, no, that's not sufficient consideration. You need to give something more than that. You also, this goes back to the notion of notice. You saw what Dr. Mark said about notice, that a lot of people, that only 30% of people, according to the study, were told about the non-compete agreement prior to the time that they were given their offer. The bill says, no, everybody's got to be told about it prior to the time, as long as there is that it is reasonable or feasible to do so. So there are circumstances where an employee might be hired in a week. Well, okay, so weeks time, days time, whatever that switch is, we recognize there's not going to be 2 weeks. But in all of the circumstances, there's a 2-week minimum requirement that the employee be given notice. And the notion there is that that protects the employee before they quit their other job. Have an offer, they know, okay, I'm going to be bound by non-compete. They get to see what it looks like, and they get to evaluate it effectively. There are threshold requirements now for when a non-compete will be enforced. In the original bill, there was a $100,000 minimum salary that an employee would have to have before a non-compete would be enforced. We heard back from many companies who were concerned that that might be okay in the context of trying to protect ourselves from employees who have goodwill, because really it's kind of the higher level employees, the employees who are earning more, generally, to the extent they're dealing with salespeople or other people with goodwill, those people are more of a threat because they've got more of the goodwill of the company. But you still have people who are earning under $100,000 who have access to trade secret and confidential information belonging to the company. And companies were concerned, well, how are we going to protect against that? And you do want to encourage companies to innovate and to share the information internally. And if you were to say that anybody under $100,000 who might have access to trade secret information can be bound by a non-compete, that was a real concern that those trade secrets may wind up leaving the company and therefore stifling the sharing of information within the company. And so the number was set low as a $50,000 cap. There's also now a 1-year limit on non-competes that is not currently the law in Massachusetts, although it is kind of the de facto assumption. Most people assume that a 1-year non-compete will be enforceable, but you can't have longer non-competes. The bill says, no, you're not going to. 1 year. If you want more than 1 year, there's only one way to do that. You can have what's called a garden leave clause, and the garden leave clause is a non-compete that's paid for post-employment. And so if the employee is not working, they're out during this restricted period, they will be paid while they're not there. And any money that they might earn in a non-competitive capacity, if they go work for somewhere else, and they're not competing, that money is on top of what's being paid for the non-compete. Because if it's important enough for an employer to protect its trade secrets, it feels that it needs, or its goodwill, it feels it needs to do so for longer than 2 years, then it has minimum requirements for how much it's going to pay the employee, and it's got to do so. And agree to the same up front. There are other changes in the law as well. There are presumptions that are created. So if you think about this now, we've been looking at it kind of from the employee's side. From the employer's side, there are presumptions of reasonableness. Remember what we talked about. There are three things that the employer needs to show: reasonable in time, reasonable in space, geographic reach, and reasonable in scope. The statute sets out ways that the employer can show that they are being reasonable and get a presumption that the non-compete in those respects is reasonable. And the way it does that, just by way of example, for time, is a non-compete that is 6 months or less will be presumptively reasonable. That is a change from current law. The current law, the general convention, although it's not said anywhere, is that 1 year is generally thought of as being reasonable. But now there's a presumption, and that enables the employer to more readily predict that the agreement will in fact be enforced. If an employee, then there are two other ways that an employer gets a presumption that the non-compete will be enforced. And those two presumptions, and again, these are rebuttable presumptions, so an employee can come in and show 6 months actually in my case wasn't reasonable, the scope wasn't reasonable, the duration wasn't reasonable. These other two aspects can also be rebutted, but they are that if an employee resigns, and this is not the employee who's laid off, this is an employee who resigns, and the notion was that they ought to be treated differently, right? If an employee resigns, they make a decision. If they're laid off or they're terminated for some other reason, they can't make that decision. So the notion was, okay, when an employee resigns, we can give the employer a way to presumptively show that the agreement is and should be enforced by the court. And the way they do that is to, A, make a decision within 2 days that they are going to basically convert the non-compete agreement into a garden leave clause, but they're still limited to the 1 year period. The other option is if you agreed in advance to a garden leave clause, then you can have your full 2 year period, up to 2 year period for the garden leave, and you'll have the presumption that it's reasonable. And the notion there is that encourages the employers to enter into garden leave clauses rather than, or to pay the employees of who resigns. That it encourages the employers to pay these people and make sure that they've got income coming in while they're doing something else, perhaps in another field, perhaps in the same field, but just not with competitive. In addition, there's another, now on the other side of things, there is a provision that allows the employee to have their legal fees paid. And they will have their legal fees paid, and it's mandatory under the legislation. They will have their legal fees paid if the employer was grossly overreaching or if the non-compete agreement was materially reformed, materially reduced in what it's going to prohibit. And that's a pretty big hammer, which encourages the employers then from the get-go, to keep these agreements narrowly tailored. The way that the employer gets around that is if they have a presumptively reasonable non-compete, then they're not at risk for the legal fees. So these are the areas where there are changes in the current law. The statute makes the application of this law essentially unavoidable. That is, somebody can't contract around it and try to get the law of another state to apply that's more restrictive, more favorable for the employer. There won't be any penalties for employees, and right now some agreements will say if you challenge this, if you lose whatever it is, you forfeit some other rights. That will not be enforced. And those are kind of the real kind of big issues in the legislation. And again, the goal of the legislation was to codify, to clarify, and to offer predictability and protection to both sides.
Thank you. Let me present my perspective on this, which is more from an intellectual property law point of view. Let me preface, too, that 20 years ago, I was a big intellectual property enforcer for digital equipment against some of the folks who are now more in the establishment today. Some of the history of non-compete agreements is that traditionally they were not enforceable except under very rare circumstances. And this was for the sale of a business. That morphed over the years into including the goodwill that a salesperson or other employee might have developed with his employment. Then it was also there to protect trade secrets. We've extended that beyond what is traditionally called trade secrets into protecting confidential information. Now, what are the reasons for non-compete agreements? From the employer's side, certainly is to invest, to protect the investment in training. We've heard that consideration. But often it's to protect intellectual property. And the view is that it's too expensive to obtain patents, and patents may be very limited in their scope, and may take too long in certain technologies. And the argument also is that trade secret suits might be too expensive as well. Underlying a lot of what I would say that my clients would oppose getting rid of non-compete agreements is that you need them to keep salaries in check. If your engineers can go somewhere else, they can command higher salaries. What are the arguments against non-compete agreements? I will say that I'm somewhat persuaded by Annalise Exanian's book on regional advantage, comparing California to Massachusetts, where Massachusetts, her argument back in the early 1990s, was that the Massachusetts industries were too much like silos with vertical integration and a lack of cross-pollinization between different companies. She left Northeastern and went to Berkeley. The argument is that there is a drag on enterprise and job creation. That is, there is an additional hurdle for spin-offs. In other words, we see new companies, but they tend to be new from the ground up rather than spin-offs from older companies. And you have hurdles that would prevent older companies going any further. I think that there is some study of this comparing California and Massachusetts in terms of digital or Fairchild begetting different companies once every 5 years, and then it gets whittled down very quickly in Massachusetts as compared to California. There's also suppression of incremental technological progress. So the idea is that you shelve technologies. And there's benefit, obviously, for the employer, the company, because sometimes you invest a lot of money in developing and you don't want yourself to even leapfrog yourself with newer technology. But there, we've talked about the human cost of career diversion. And again, from the employee side, it keeps salaries down. Now, what intellectual property are we protecting? There are copyrights, there are patents, the trademarks, which actually relates somewhat to the idea of a goodwill, the identity of the company, or the trademark of the company, and trade secrets. And how, the question is, how far does that enter into all confidential information? What belongs to the employee? Skills learned have traditionally been viewed as belonging to an employee, although I think that from the point of view of loyalty, then many employers feel that, well, I've trained you, therefore you owe me loyalty. That tradition has not been something that's been recognized by law. What about the relationships that have been developed? Whose goodwill is it? And we have a lot of these issues coming up in terms of people doing blogs and other issues that don't immediately come to mind, but they are in the background. Well, what confidential information should be protected? Private company information. You don't want to tell people you're traveling, visiting a prospect. You don't want to have someone say your company's doing badly, or what the reporting structure is internally. Is disclosure of these things actionable or contract, or is it cause for firing? To some extent, perhaps. It may well depend on the nature of the business. Trouble is that most non-disclosure agreements do over-include, and necessarily so. If I'm drafting one for my client, I'm going to try to make sure that everything's covered. But maybe it covers things that might not really, if you looked at it carefully, should be covered. In the recorded decisions, there's rarely an analysis of the information at all, if it's technical at all. So you see cases where if it's a technology company, whether it's biotech or information technology, there's very little discussion of whether is this really confidential, is this not available somewhere else. Sometimes there is, but primarily, most of the time, there isn't. In the information technology side, what is the question? Is this IP of the employer or the skills of the employee? The reality is that in terms of code, the code that it's written by an employee is protected anyway under copyright law because it's a work for hire. This is not necessarily true for consultants unless you contract for that specifically, but the code by employee will belong to the employer. But then there's a question of what are thought reusable algorithms. Sometimes you may try to patent these, but in many cases, most developers feel that this is part of their own little bag of tricks and their own skill. There may be an issue about knowledge of the platform. If I know inside of how Windows operates and where the hooks are and what the various variable names and locations, that is valuable and maybe should be kept secret. There are many questions about what should be reverse engineerable and what should not be. There are questions too about whether mass market software contracts, whether click wrap or shrink wrap and these other things, are really enforceable. And there's been some compromise generally in Europe and as well as the United States on what should be allowed to be reverse engineered. Information technology workers, and I think Professor Marsh has mentioned this, tend to be, on the younger side, viewed as fungible. Therefore, the non-competes or overly broad non-disclosure agreements are rarely challenged. If someone's coming to me, if I'm hiring, if I'm representing a startup company that seeks to hire an engineer, I see he or she has a non-compete agreement, forget it. There's no reason, no way to hire this. If I'm representing venture capital, company, for the most part, I'm looking at a new at a startup and saying, well, they really want this particular developer, not a big agreement, you don't want to touch it. So most of these things just never get anywhere. It's a little bit different in the life sciences. Information inventions are more separable from the skills. And there are patentable processes, and there are processes that may be secret, and they're kept, it can be kept secret compared to mass market software where the code is actually out there in some form, not source code form. A star scientist can negotiate limitations to their non-competes. They may negotiate more salary. They may take up abandoned research if you don't take this project further. I can proceed that on my own. The new employers also tend to be willing to take risk lawsuits for the stars who. Because you might have such a start that person would attract investment. So I think that the life sciences are quite different from the IT space. So what happens in terms of trade secrets? In Massachusetts, we have a definition right now that is very, very bare bones. It talks about a secret. The question is, what does it mean to be a secret? Instead, the courts haven't tended to look at this particular provision. They've tended to look at the common law, and the common law that we've adopted is the 1939 Restatement of Torts, which has this provision in the comments, which defines what a trade secret is. The problem here is that people have focused, some courts have focused on the word used, and they focused on this saying that it has to be in continuous use. This has led to a number of very strange results. So one example being that I know of one situation where a trade secret plaintiff alleged that a Indian outsourcing company had taken their trade secrets and were now the plaintiff was really put out of business. And the judge in that case referred back to this continuous use requirement and said, well, you're not using the trade secret anymore, so this trade secret count goes out, which is a really bizarre result. That if someone puts you out of business by stealing a trade secret, so you're no longer continuously using it, therefore the trade secret is not a trade secret. But it's what, in some ways, what this has happened, this has resulted in is an expansion, and in my view, an expansion of our enforcement of non-compete agreements, moving away from the traditional idea of just protecting trade secrets, protecting anything that's confidential. And some judges will go behind and say that you can't make something confidential by a contract. That's probably not necessarily true. It's I think there's some things that you can make confidential by contract, but I think that what you often see, unless everything is put before a judge who's willing to go behind and measure what is this really kind of confidentiality that you need to protect by a non-compete agreement, often you see that, well, you sign the non-compete agreement, you sign the non-disclosure agreement that says everything's confidential unless you can prove it otherwise. You can imagine, they're just different legitimate views of that. And what the Uniform Trade Secret Act does, which has been adopted by 45 states and District of Columbia, and it turns out that Massachusetts, in some of these studies, has been shown to be at the, even though there aren't that many states, it's only California right now that specifically bans non-compete agreements. Massachusetts is actually very high on the list of states that enforce non-compete agreements compared to other states. Professor Marks can speak to that as well. The Uniform Trade Secret Act extends the idea of trade secrets to many of the areas that I would consider to be protectable confidential information. In other words, this would no longer require that the trade secret would be in actual use and continuous use. It may be potential. This might protect the situation where what we call inevitable disclosure, someone who has strategic information who's leaving a position to go to a competitor with the strategic information, which may be valuable for 6 months, a year, maybe longer. And that can be protected under the Trade Secret Act, Uniform Trade Secret Act. So what H329, the history of that is that this organization, the Boston Bar Association, worked in 1995 to actually tweak the Uniform Trade Secret Act a little bit to bring it up to deal with some of the issues that we have seen here in Massachusetts. One was to actually require trade secrets to be specified. I harken back to a case that I worked on for digital equipment against Emulex Corporation, where we managed to get an injunction that basically protected the introduction of about $300 million worth of disk drives. We never had to tell the judge what we said was a trade secret. We merely said that this guy had had access to all these secrets and that he went to the competitor. And he actually, we showed that he actually had a disk. So the idea is that he did clearly take something, steal something. And we got an injunction that was ultimately reversed, but it gave them a window to introduce their product. So the idea is that if trade secrets are viewed as property, they ought to be specifiable and delineated, both told to the employees that this particular piece of information is property and you can't take it with you. We also changed the act to allow attorney's fees to defendants as well as complainants for bad faith litigation. And we also used it to displace 93A. What was added more recently was that to address some of these issues with non-compete agreements is to say that contractual remedies based on confidential information should at least go through the analysis that is applied to trade secrets, that is, that these this confidential information is not readily ascertainable by proper means, and that they're subject to measures that are reasonable under the circumstances, which might well be by contract. If you specify something and say, you know, this is a secret, maybe that's enough to be reasonable in those circumstances. So we, this is a bill that was introduced by Representative Bosley and Senator Hart, and we had a hearing on this. I included the hearing, my testimony, that in your materials. Michael. Okay.
Steve, are you still on schedule break? It was on the. Let's keep going.
Yeah, we people need a break, I think. Yeah, let's just keep going.
Okay.
So, Michael, maybe you can give your responses to what's going on here.
Thank you. I'm here to attempt to articulate the argument for maintaining what I gather, what I'm guessing is probably the unpopular position in this room. Which is for the status quo.
There's a judge here.
And I appreciate that. And I should say as a starting point maybe a disclaimer, that I'm not an apologist for non-competes. I litigate all sides of these issues as the other practitioners at this table do. By the way, I'm sensitive to the concern that the only people who make out well in the current environment are the lawyers who litigate on all sides of this. So I am sensitive to those concerns, and I appreciate that there are situations in which non-competes are abused. There are situations in which employees should not be required to sign them. There are situations where employers who have required people to sign them should not attempt to enforce them after they leave. So I don't mean to say that what we have at present in Massachusetts is perfection, but I don't think there's such a thing as perfection. And that is because what we're dealing with here is an inherent tension, tension between, as Representative Brownsberger was talking about and others have talked about, between employer interests and employee interests. And it's my role here to argue that the common law-based system, essentially case law, judge-made law, in which judges weigh the evidence, taking into account the myriad interests at stake in these cases, although not perfect, is the best approach to addressing the competing interests at stake. I'm going to speak briefly about the sort of no non-compete idea, what was the initial proposal in Representative Brownsberger's initial bill to abolish non-competes except in sale of business situations. And then I'll talk a bit about the compromise legislation that both Representative Brownsberger and Russ Buck, in fact, had described. But I want to suggest, as I mentioned, I think there's, among a lot of the different tensions in play here, there's a tension in this debate between the desire for certainty, for knowing exactly what's going to happen when somebody leaves, and the need for some flexibility in weighing all of these competing interests. And I'm concerned that the compromise legislation brings some certainty to the situation, but it may do so in ways that are disadvantageous for all sides involved. And I'll try to explain why I'm saying that. So the principal argument for favoring the status quo, continued enforceability of non-competes in Massachusetts, is that there are, in fact, situations where a company's legitimate interests in its confidential information, truly confidential information, and its customer relationships, which is sometimes called goodwill, those interests are most appropriately protected
via a non-compete restriction. Now, there are categories of employees, often but not exclusively, they tend to be the more senior employees in an organization, in whom significant information and relationships are entrusted, who would pose a meaningful threat to that company were they to be able to go freely to a competitor doing something very similar to what they were doing. And that such activity, going to a competitor with this information having been entrusted in them, would provide an unfair competitive advantage to the new employer. That's the sort of the basic concern that underlies and supports the enforcement of non-competes in Massachusetts at present. And the idea, the notion here is that that interest in protecting truly confidential information and goodwill is not adequately protected via a non-disclosure agreement, statutory protections of trade secrets, non-solicitation agreements, that there are some situations in which the non-compete is the most appropriate and really only viable tool to protect those interests. And we have these concepts that have been developed that Russ already described, I think, quite beautifully, of reasonableness in time and space, consonant with public policy, necessary to protect the legitimate business interests of the company. The courts have always been very clear. A legitimate business interest is not simply to stop competition. A legitimate business interest is to preserve confidential information and customer goodwill. And that a non-compete that's narrowly tailored, applied to somebody who is in possession of confidential information or goodwill, is an appropriate way to protect a company's interest. The current system we have, which is judge-made law developed over many years, is a finely honed one, which allows judges to weigh all of the different interests at stake and to determine whether or not compete should be enforced in a particular situation. Now, as to what I call the California approach, I would suggest that those who look to California, and there are many in this room, I appreciate that, and I respect your views on this, and I think very thoughtful, and ultimately they may carry the day, so I'm just simply trying to sort of add to the debate. But I don't think those who look to the California approach are really focusing or arguing directly against what I just said. Instead, what they're sort of changing the discussion, they're saying, hey, look at California. They don't let people, they don't let companies enforce or acquire non-competes, and things have worked out okay in California. So we ought to follow a similar model. And in fact, we think that we're losing to California because we've had these non-competes that have been enforceable for all these years, and that's been a drag on innovation and labor mobility. And I would suggest, and with all due respect to Dr. Marks's research, I think as research develops here, where legislatures are going to go with this, I think it's going to be a very interesting issue. But I'm not convinced that to the extent that we can all conclude, and even that's an issue, to the extent we're going to conclude that California's tech sector has developed in a better way or more rapidly, or that bigger and better companies have developed out there, that we can say the precipitating factor causing that has been the enforceability of non-competes in Massachusetts. I think there are too many other factors in play. We see arguments in the tech community, in the VC community, in Massachusetts, all the time about what factors are in play, from weather to, you know, topography to a lot of different factors that are obviously very unrelated to whether or not one state enforces non-competes. And I think there's a real question about, and there are many who say, we haven't developed the really big, incredibly successful companies, particularly in the tech sector, as they have in California, and that's because of the enforceability of non-competes here. And I'm not convinced that we see that direct causal sort of evidence at this point. And I also want to say, as to the California model, there are those that sort of see California as a panacea, and I think proponents of that model overstate the extent to which companies and employees have it free and easy because non-competes don't exist or largely don't exist out there. Yes, companies cannot impose non-competes on employees except in sale of business situations, which are very limited situations. But that doesn't mean that they've rid themselves of the scourge of lawyers and litigation in California. There is rampant trade secret misappropriation, breach of fiduciary duty, breach of the computer, violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, breach of non-solicitation, litigation going on all the time in California, companies suing each other and ex-employees over taking information and using it in another position. So there's plenty of litigation and there's plenty of things keeping lawyers busy in California, even without the enforcement of non-compete. And I would suggest that there's a fundamental problem with the approach of trying to protect confidential information simply through trade secret litigation, which is essentially what California has. If you think somebody's gone to a competitor and is using your trade secrets, unlike in Massachusetts, you can't say, oh, this person signed a non-compete, it's enforceable for the following reasons, let's stop it before the trade secrets are being used. In California, you have to, and if you go to a no non-compete model, you have to wait for evidence that your trade secrets are being used and then sue for breach of for misappropriation of trade secrets for breach of a non-disclosure agreement. That, in most instances, is going to be a far more complicated, long-lived, expensive case than a non-compete injunction case. And I appreciate that a non-compete injunction case, where, just to be clear what I'm talking about, the typical model for enforcing a non-compete in Massachusetts or any of the other states where they're enforceable is for the enforcing company to go into court and seek what is called a preliminary injunction, an order from a judge requiring the employee to stop working for the competitor, essentially preliminarily enforcing the non-compete. Because of the nature of the litigation process, that ends up being a battle that, in most instances, decides the war, decides the case. If the judge says, yes, well, I'll enforce the non-compete, then the person's not going to be able to work there. If the judge says, no, I won't enforce the non-compete, you conceivably could have continue to have a case, but the person is going to be allowed to work there. And that is typically a few weeks, maybe a couple of months, and that injunction case is essentially decided and it's over with. And it's expensive, and I appreciate that it's a burden for everybody who's involved in it, but it's nothing compared to trade secret misappropriation litigation. So I would suggest that non-competes are actually a reasonably efficient way to deal with the interest at stake as compared with trade secret litigation. Also want to say something briefly about what I call sort of a market-based argument, which is I want to suggest that this is a matter best left to the market. Companies are not required to impose non-competes on employees, and there are more and more companies and the VCs that support them, like Spark Capital, which is represented here today by Bijan Sabat. And I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. I'm sorry if I'm not. I'm sorry about that.
My position.
You're not with Spark?
No, I am, but you're representing our position.
Okay, well, there are some venture capitalists, I believe, and I certainly want to leave time later for everyone to have an opportunity to discuss their positions, who have said that we're not going to require the companies that we invest in to require non-competes of their employees. There are companies, I have clients, that do not require non-competes of their employees. There are employees, obviously, who have the choice whether or not to sign a non-compete. And ultimately, companies and individuals can vote with their feet. And if the marketplace determines that non-competes are bad for the marketplace, one would think that the marketplace would sort that out. In terms of, just so that we have time for the general discussion, in terms of the compromise legislation, which is the legislation that was being described earlier, I think it's an impressive attempt to try to address a number of concerns that have been raised about non-competes. And I believe a number of the features of the bill are laudable. For example, it's hard for me to argue that or argue against the notion that a company that wants an employee to sign a non-compete, a new hire, should tell that person in the offer letter, tell that person before he or she arrives on the doorstep to take the new job. And I certainly advise my clients to do that. And most of the offer letters that I see, that, and frankly, when I'm on the other side, most of the offer letters that I see that relate to this issue would say, we're offering you this position. It's going to be at X, Y, or Z salary and benefits. A condition of employment is going to be that you sign our standard non-disclosure, non-solicitation agreement, which is attached here too. It gives the person an opportunity to consider whether or not he or she wants to take the job knowingly, knowing that they're going to have to sign a non-compete. I can't argue against that. When I'm on the other side arguing against the enforcement of non-competes, if the facts are that somebody was sort of lured into the job, accepted it, gave up another job, moved across the country, and, you know, on the first day was told, here's the most onerous non-compete written in the history of the world, and you're going to have to sign it. I'm always going to be, if I'm on the defense side, going to be arguing duress, coercion, to contract of adhesion, and it shouldn't be enforced. And I think most Massachusetts judges will have difficulty enforcing it in unfair circumstances like that. So I don't mean to suggest that that feature of the bill, for example, is, I think, in isolation, particularly problematic. But I do have some concern that that it's a pretty complicated piece of legislation as it's currently drafted. A lot of care and attention has gone into it. I understand why the things that are in it are in it. But I'm concerned that it's going to force companies to go through a lot of hoops or risk losing the ability to protect what I think everyone is conceding are legitimate interests. And I respectfully suggest that another sort of additional layer of regulation for businesses is not necessarily a good thing in Massachusetts. Some particular points, I guess, I'd like to make. The legislation has these, as has been described, has some salary thresholds. So non-competes are automatically unenforceable if the person is making less than $50,000 a year. And non-competes will not be enforceable for people who make between $50,000 and $100,000 a year. If the only interest that is being preserved is customer relationships. Or to put it differently, if you make between $50,000 and $100,000, the non-compete is going to be enforceable only if its purpose is to protect confidential information. If you make less than $50,000, there's no interest that's worthy of protecting, and the non-compete is unenforceable. And I understand the intent here, which is to screen out lower-level employees who ought not to have to sign a non-compete. But my concern is that it's a method that's too inexact. There are a lot of industries, particularly tech startups, in which nobody's making much of anything for the first year or two or three of the company's existence. So you would have people who are doing very significant things. VP of product development, COO, head of sales, who may only be making $40,000 a year with the hope of making a lot more downstream when everything hopefully goes well. And under this legislation, none of those people could be subject to non-competes. And I would suggest that's not where you want to go, at least in that particular industry. So there may be a different way to categorize this, or maybe you, one thought I had was maybe you draw the line at those who would be considered exempt from under the Fair Labor Standards Act, those who have more significant duties, so that you're not hitting kind of entry-level people. But I'm concerned that that's sort of too blunt a sword when it comes to the concern that's in play. There is, as was described, a presumption of enforceability if the non-compete is only 6 months in duration and certain other criteria are met. And I'm kind of surprised by that, actually, because I think in the end that you will be creating an incentive for there to actually be more enforceable non-competes in mass. If the goal is to reduce the number of people who can be subject to non-competes and the instances in which non-competes could be enforced, I wonder whether creating this sort of presumption of enforceability for non-competes of 6 months or shorter will actually result in
employers jumping at that and then running into court and saying, Your Honor, this non-compete is presumptively enforceable, and now you're forcing the employee to show why that shouldn't be the case. Whereas under the current status quo, the presumption is always against enforcement, and the employer has the burden of showing at every step along the way in the process that the non-compete is enforceable. So I understand that the idea is to give something to the business interest in play here, but I just want to throw that out there. And the last thing I'll say, because I know we're running short on time, is that the limitation of 1 year of duration, unless you pay what the so-called garden leave, I think is overreaching for employers. If an employer has a legitimate basis for enforcing, that is, to draft a narrowly tailored, reasonable non-compete under the standards that have been in place for all these years, I don't think, and I'll just be brief on this, I don't think that requiring them to sign to pay another 50% or more of the person's salary in order to get beyond that 1 year ought to be necessary. And it should be left to a judge to decide what the appropriate length should be. So I'll stop there.
Okay. Shall we take some time for comments from the panel? Do we want to go back to the...
We can open it up and give Scott the first shot.
Unless you have the first question.
No, I was going to make a few remarks, but since the time is short,
I would like to hear from Judge Dorfer. One of the things I neglected to mention was that your law review article was on trade secrets and preemption by patents and antitrust.
Yes, it was. It was the high point of my career, 1967, and it's still there. Just a couple of things. First of all, and I know you've all thought about this, but we're focusing on information technology and intellectual property. I would just say that, of course, the statute that we're looking at is a general statute dealing with all kinds of companies. So before too long, I think it should be looked upon. I mean, I sat in the trial court for 19 years, and I heard a fair number of preliminary injunctions, and there weren't too many involving high tech. And there's a lot of preliminary injunctions, non-competes dealing with real estate agents and salespeople and hairdressers and things like that. So you got to think through, you got to kind of vet it to make sure this is going to work for everybody. Secondly, it might help. Just to frame this, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I just think everybody ought to have in front of them sort of the language that you've been referring to as sort of the traditional test that trial judges and appellate judges use when considering the validity of these. And this is just a quote. It said, a covenant restraining trade or competition inserted in the contract for personal service is not in itself invalid if the interest to be protected is consonant with public policy, and if the restraint is limited reasonably in time and space. What is reasonable depends upon facts. And then it goes on to talk about in determining whether a covenant will be enforced in whole or in part, the reasonable needs of the former employer for protection against harmful conduct of the former employee must be weighed against both the reasonableness of the restraint imposed on the former employee and the public interest. A covenant too broad in any respect will be enforced only to the extent that it is reasonable and to the extent that it is severable for the purposes of enforcement. Now, that's a lot. Okay, and it also, as you observed, puts a lot into the lap of the judge who has to evaluate things on a case-by-case basis. That's, you could regard that as either a plus or a minus. In the statute, has the benefit of specific language, specific guidelines, and so on. Whereas the present status is the judges are being asked to take a factual record and a whole set of circumstances and spend a day or so or more looking at all the facts and circumstances and trying to decide whether or not a particular covenant is reasonable or enforceable. So those are the two observations that I would do. Turn it over to
Well, thank you. So I had a lot of questions that were raised by the presentations, but if I were to maybe respond to one thing that Michael, you said, and ask a question of Representative Brownsberger and Mr. Beck, I guess what I would say is that, you know, not to look too much at California, but I feel like this is really the one lever that we have on innovation. We can't change the weather. We can't change the, you know, kite surfing conditions in Boston, but we can change the legislation around non-competes. And if you look at, Judge Jerford, what you said about, you know, hairdressers and real estate agents, if you look at the five Massachusetts companies that are in the NASDAQ 100 index in terms of, you know, most valuable, most employees, it's not real estate firms and hair salon, it's Genzyme and Vertex and Akamai Technologies and Staples and one or two other companies. The question I would ask to you two is, you know, I'm very persuaded by Dr. Marks's data. And so when big companies and their lobbyists come to you and say, this would be terrible if we got rid of non-competes in Massachusetts, it would be a disaster, do you ask them for any data or any proof points of how damaging it is when an employee leaves and goes to start another business or works for a startup? I mean, to me, it would seem you'd want some measurements of what is the impact on EMC if one of their best engineers leaves to go start another company in storage. And, you know, Dr. Marks, if you have data on that, you know, that it really does damage Google and EMC and these other big companies when someone leaves, you know, maybe you'll chime in.
But just for the webcast, I'll abbreviate your question, which is, do large companies pose empirical data to you as legislators or as academicians on the effects of non-competing periods?
Well, so far I haven't really heard from the large companies. I've ran into some of the lobbyists for the Associated Industries of Massachusetts and let them know I'd be interested in hearing from them, you know, from their groups, how they feel about it. And I've kind of got the general drift that, you know, the EMCs and so forth don't like this, but I haven't really heard from them. What I have heard, I think, is actually a lot more compelling than sort of a single state natural experiment, you know, which I believe that we should change now because I believe they harm our venture climate, but I don't think that the data that we have from that one state tells us how we should change non-competes. I think that the best part of Dr. Martin's research, the most persuasive stuff for me in that research, is the data about the kinds of things that are happening with non-competes. I think that's fascinating. That survey data is very, very interesting. And I think what that survey data shows is if we pass this bill, we will dramatically change the practice around non-competes in this state. I mean, the idea that a lot of people are being handed these very serious agreements on the last, you know, on the day they walk in or even afterwards, I mean, that's a very serious, that's a big change we make. And then I think you have to, and the idea that a lot of these agreements are lasting for a year or more, or 2 years or 5 years, I think this legislation will effectively push the typical non-compete down to the six-month level. Because we by creating this safe harbor, these presumptions, we're giving employers and saying if you're outside those presumptions and you're wrong, Mr. Employer, you're going to pay the employee's attorney's fees. We have created an enormous reason for people to stay inside those presumptions unless they have a very, very important interest to protect. So what I think you're going to see is instead of, you know, the majority of agreements being a year or more, you're going to see them down at the six-month level. And I think that's going to be a huge change. And I think that's going to be good for the venture climate. It's going to be good for employees. And at the same time, I think you're going to see the ability of employers to protect themselves when they really do have an articulable interest that they need to protect for a longer period of time. So I think it's going to be a big change.
Yes. I've enjoyed the discussion today, so it was very informative, actually. I have two questions, and there might be a statement or two. One, you can't fix speeding tickets. No, it's just a shot in the dark. Russell, what I've had to deal with previously as an employee is I live in Massachusetts, but in my contract it says all law disputes, all legal disputes will take place in the state of New York or state of Delaware where the company is incorporated. So that kind of makes some of what we're, I guess my question is, does that make some of what we're talking about here moot? As someone who's also been a corporate officer and faced with this issue, the only people that I required to sign non-competes are those that also had key man insurance, because if you're key enough to the company that the company wants to insure your brain, then I would want you to sign a non-compete. You had mentioned that non-competes, in your view, protect intellectual property, and I would respectfully disagree. I think what they're intended to do is protect intellectual capital, and you can't control what's in a person's head, so you might as well try to control what company he's going to go work for with that head. And what I would tell employees is that it gives you a hell of a weapon to say, sounds like I'm worthy of a stay bonus, don't you think? And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. So that's...
Well, he can repeat the question for you.
I think the question was, really comes down to, is a choice of law provision in a contract, in a non-compete agreement that specifies law other than Massachusetts, does that render what we've been talking about to some extent moot? And not surprisingly, the answer is no. First, choice of law provision under current law will presumptively be enforced, but the courts will look at whether it ought to be enforced or not, and there's a test that applies to that. But the legislation, in particular, and I don't have reading glasses with me, and this is a new thing for me, so, but it looks like it's Section J.
Section I.
I'm sorry, Section I, thank you. Somebody can read better than I. The Section I restricts the application of a choice of law provision for someone who has been living or working in Massachusetts for a relatively brief period, and at the end of the, you know, when their employment terminates, 30 days with the so any provision that says New York law, which is less restrictive, will govern, more restrictive court, or some other law, there's Florida law, which is a particularly onerous statute, that won't govern. Massachusetts law will govern, and the company can't avoid that.
Yeah,
there's
a...
Well, thank you all very much, and you've all obviously given a lot of thought to this. I think that you're right, Representative Brownsberger, about some of the procedures, but I'm very persuaded by at least the position Michael Rosen just gave about the flexibility. Like you guys, I litigate on both sides. I also advise one of the constituencies that wasn't really mentioned is the employer who wants to hire somebody in, and that's often where I am. One of the things I thought, though, with you were saying about the attorney's fees, and that's a disincentive. One thing that happens in court is blue lining. The courts will not necessarily enforce the agreement the way that it's written and will make it enforceable. And that actually is an incentive, it's always seemed to me, to write it as over-inclusive as you want, and then the judge will do justice. And so I don't know where I come out on it, and so I really am asking all of your opinion. What if instead of attorney's fees, or maybe in addition to, there was a no blue lining rule in it? And so then that gives the employer the incentive to write it. It gives you the flexibility that Michael was talking about in terms of meeting your own needs, and so you don't have to have the courts really sort of, or the legislature doing it so broad stroke, it's 6 months for $50,000 and all of that. It really doesn't meet the need of the organization. You let the court do justice, and so you accomplish that goal that way. And I don't know what the downside is, but I bet there is one.
A suggestion, summary of the question was that would be appropriate to eliminate blue lining so that this would force employers to draft things reasonably and properly in the first place.
Can I respond to that?
So I'm not a lawyer. I don't play on TV. But I will tell you that maybe it's in the setting that we're in. The gist I get is that judges will do the right thing when they see the agreement. But I can tell you from my research, judges rarely see these agreements. Most of the people who didn't change jobs or left the industry didn't do so because they got sued, because they got a cease and desist letter. They assumed it would be enforced because they signed it. The legal system never entered into it. So if there's no check on what companies can put in front of you and make you sign, regardless of whether it's in the offer letter or not, people assume they're bound by it. I signed a 2-year non-compete in my first job. I assumed that I had to live on every bit of it. So there's really this chilling effect. I worry if we say, well, judges will do the right thing. They know how to handle these. Because in the vast majority of cases I've seen, the judges have no role.
Can I follow that? That concern was very much in my mind as I considered this situation, that so many people will not have the ability to consult attorneys. The approach that we have here presumes that employers
will, in fact, have frequently the opportunity to consult with attorneys when they, in fact, almost always will begin a negotiating advice when they draft the agreements that they're trying to put in front of people. And the attorneys will know about this legislation and will advise the attorney, their employers, that they're much better off drawing these things narrowly. And the employer can push back and say, well, I got a reason. And then you can say, well, I guess that is defensible. But the way we approach this in the legislation, the blue lining question, is we debated, you know, should we eliminate blue lining? But we said, no, let's allow the judge to blue line, because that might be the right thing for them to do occasionally. But we say, if an employer overreached and the agreement was subject to some blue lining by the judge, the employer is paying the attorney's fees. So
it can be enforceable and you still have to pay attorney's fees.
If you backed it off, if you overreached employers, you're paying attorney's fees. So that's a very powerful thing. So you're going to see people being very careful about the agreements that they choose to draft. And it does give them the right to protect their interests.
That's a substantial reformation. So if it's a very minor change, there's no attorney's fees. Am I correct?
That is correct. It's got to be a material change.
But if it's a material change, then, you know.
My perspective on the blue lining issue, for whatever it's worth, certainly if you got rid of blue lining, although Massachusetts doesn't actually say that it's doing blue lining, it's the notion that the judge can enforce it to the extent reasonable. So the judge has a lot of freedom to craft an appropriate order to weigh these different interests. So certainly if you go to a model that gets rid of that power, and there are some states that have done that, I mean, Georgia's one, for example, you do force employers to have to be much more exact on an employee-by-employee basis about what exactly it is that they want to impose. And the concern I have in representing employers in that context is that it's impossible to anticipate every possibility downstream, and it's nice to have, you know, if there's something that nobody anticipated, to have the ability on the judge's part to say, well, this person can go to this company but not do X, Y, or Z, and that may not be contemplated in the specific language of the agreement. So that's the problem with the no blue lining situation.
Yes, I'm sorry, there's 2 years in my life.
Back when I was in law school a number of years back, I felt a certain notion with regard to companies. And now being a general counsel for a largely a staffing company whose major clients are largely biotech companies, I've got the good fortune of being able to keep that notion. And that's basically that what we're talking about here is sort of an intellectual property of sorts. You know, if it was a musician we were talking about, the musician created a certain new sound, then if there was no intellectual property to protect him, obviously he'd be disincentive to making music, to drop out and protect Elvis or whatever. That would be a great shame. If you protect him too much, it's a loss to the community. And I guess what we have here, whenever you have a company who creates something, you know, whether it's by tweaking somebody, by finding somebody who was across the country, and tweaking their resume a little bit and then submitting it to a company, for instance, and then that company says, wow, that's cool, I don't know why I didn't say that before. Whether you take a salesperson and you give them all these notions about, you know, you tell about, you know, this particular client's manager has no kids but has three nieces and he loves them to death. And you build up these things, you're making these machines, you're making these creations, and then you're going off and selling them. And so there's, again, that same tension. You know, that tension between if you overprotect the company, then you're jipping, essentially, the community. But if you underprotect the company, it's a disincentive. And so there's a balance that needs to be struck. And so my question is that hopefully you realize that this is a grand experiment. And if you recognize that, are you going to put any guidelines in by which you're going to be evaluating the progress of this law once it's passed, you know, cross your fingers, such that you can reevaluate it and so that you can adjust for the future?
The question is whether or not this proposed bills could have some sort of evaluation function, so that considering that it is a grand experiment, is there any opportunity to change it down the line?
Well, I think it's a terribly interesting question, and we don't have anything like that built into the bill right now, and I'm not just sure how to create that metric, but certainly anything we did, we'd want to look at every metric we could put our hands on to see how it in fact was working and continue to attention to it for some years to come. That was my other line of sight.
Right. Hi, everybody. I'm Dijon Seb. I'm a partner at a firm in Boston called Spark Capital. And I just had a couple quick questions and comments. If you don't mind, but I'll make them quite brief. You know, I think the spirit of the venture capital point of view here gets pigeonholed as an employee entrepreneurial point of view only and kind of doesn't respect or isn't cognizant of businesses. And it's actually not true. We're fiduciaries of these companies. You know, I'm on the board of my partners and I on the board of dozens of companies. Some have been public companies, some have been private. We're fiduciaries. And so we are very much looking at the best interest of the shareholder and the company. So this idea that we have tension between employer and employee is something we deal with every single day. So certainly if we're investors in a company and a week later after we invest millions of dollars in the company, you know, a bunch of engineers leave the building in the middle of the night and start a competitor for our California companies, we are very cognizant of this issue. And our balance as a VC industry, and in Massachusetts, I think VCs represent some, you know, several billions of dollars every year that we deploy. We have a situation now where every year we are investing less than Massachusetts. You know, it's just statistically true. So when Mr. Rosen said, let the market decide, the market's deciding. You know, so we are investing more outside of this market, you know, quarter after quarter. We had a situation where in the mid-70s, Massachusetts was the parity between the rest of the country. You know, California and Massachusetts were about the same. You know, we look every 10 years and it just does this with new companies, venture capital, et cetera. So we have an experiment, it's happening, and you can see it. The other comment I'll make is this notion about you know, fairness, which is we have now an economic environment where employees are getting laid off. And as a result of this layoff, they're not bound by the way. So people are getting laid off, and they're still bound by these non-competes. It's just, there's a fairness issue here that I can deal with. The other thing that, I don't know how many people here have worked in California, just show up and some people have worked in California. Yeah, so this is not an issue. They don't talk about it. They don't gather a room like this. They don't try to bring non-competes back. They're very competitive companies. Steve Jobs, Larry, Sergey, Eric Schmidt, this is not a conversation that they're having. They're trying to figure out how to get H1 visas expanded. They're trying to figure out how to deal with net neutrality. They are trying to deal with e-commerce taxation. This is not hurting their businesses. They don't care. And I invest in many companies in California. One thing I would agree with Mr. Rosen is I think this bill is too complicated. I suggest we just get rid of non-competes altogether. Employees and employers, we can have this balance where employers are protected by non-solicitation agreements and non-and confidentiality agreements, non-disclosure agreements. And I guess the last thing I'll say is what Matt said, which is that this chilling effect is a really big deal. This notion about employees that are making $100,000, give or take, they don't have the means all over the world to have a $50,000 lawsuit. So this just becomes a non-starter for employees. So that's it. Thanks a lot for your time.
Yeah, let me just repeat a couple of things that Mr. Savitt suggested. That he feels that the market has already spoken in terms of the drop in venture capital investment in Massachusetts compared to California, I guess. And certainly one comment about the even $100,000 limit, that $100,000 salary would not allow people to litigate these non-competes.
Steve, can I address a couple things? First, on the latter point, that is the employee not being able to address this kind of case. There are two ways to respond to that. Number one is very frequently, and it's not always the case, but very frequently the new employer is aware of the non-compete and will stand by the employee, or you never get to this point to begin with. The second thing is, and this goes to the other point as well, which is that in your layoff concern, the current economy, section, and again, I'm going to try to read this one, I can see better, G3, talks about the court having the ability, in addition to other reasons, to not enforce the non-compete where otherwise necessary to prevent injustice or an unduly harsh result. And that's one of several different ways
that
a court is not enforced.
That seems to go to court.
I'm sorry?
That That's right.
But this is, that's right, but this is a change to the current law, which would always go to the court under current law.
Under the default.
That's right.
For status quo.
That's right.
I'm sorry, that just so I understand correctly, that layoff scenario would only, the employee would only get relieved if it gets dealt with the courts, as the court will decide.
That's right.